École normale supérieure, savoir en multimédia.
L'œuvre de M. Bogossian en anglais est très variée et il est connu davantage en France pour sa réfutation du relativisme d'une manière générale, puisque il a un livre en français paru en 2009, je crois, 2009, you don't remember, 2008, ok, qui s'appelle « La peur de savoir » sur le relativisme et le constructivisme de la connaissance. Dans ce livre, Paul Bogossian réfute sans le moindre esprit polémique le relativisme et le constructivisme sous toutes leurs formes, et avec cet énorme intérêt philosophique, c'est qu'il les prend dans leur version la plus sérieuse et qu'il les défend parfois mieux qu'eux-mêmes, si je puis dire, c'est-à-dire avec les arguments les plus sérieux, avant, évidemment, de réfuter ses thèses. Alors je pense que c'est au même exercice qui va se livrer aujourd'hui, mais à propos d'un relativisme dont il parle un peu, mais pas beaucoup, dans La peur du savoir, qui est surtout consacré au relativisme épistémique, relativisme de la connaissance, et sa forme, disons, son envers, qui est le constructivisme social de la connaissance. Donc c'est sur le relativisme à propos des normes et à propos des normes morales. C'est le thème de son exposé. Merci Paul de ta visite, je te donne la parole.
Mes amis m'ont dit que j'aurais un succès fou si je donnerais cet exposé en français, mais moi je pense que je serais fou de l'essayer. Alors je suis désolé, je vais parler principalement en anglais, mais de temps en temps, peut-être je vais lire ces mots traduits sur le handout par Francis. Merci. So, I want to talk about relativism, about morality, in particular, and more generally about relativism, about normative domains, that is, domains of discourse which are involved in prescribing or evaluating opposed to merely describing things. And I want to outline certain very fundamental, what I take to be fundamental difficulties in making sense of relativistic views of normative domains. Now, the word relativism has been used to designate lots and lots of different kinds of positions. And I will, in fact, be taking a look at two main ideas that have gone by that label. But for me, the most important, historically important, root idea behind a relativistic view has been the idea that there are faultless disagreements within a certain domain. So in particular, in the case of morality, to have a relativistic view of morality would be to say that you can have real disagreements about morality, but where it can be the case that both the person who says the one thing and the person who is disagreeing can both be correct in some sense. Now, let's just introduce this idea by looking at what will look like a very frivolous case, Le Chou de Bruxelles. Suppose you have a disagreement between Francis and
we
me.
Have
we
have,
have a disagreement. Yes, you don't like them.
Oh, no.
Sont dégoûtants.
No,
okay. I say Brussels sprouts are delicious. Francis says they're horrible. They're not delicious at all. You just look at that disagreement. Now, it looks like, on the surface, at least, there is a véritable désaccord, a real disagreement between us, because it looks like I am saying that Brussels sprouts have a certain property, being delicious, and he is denying it. Now, you could take the view that really what's going on there is that we are, instead of asserting 1 and 2 on the handout, we are respectively asserting 3 and 4. That is, I'm saying, moi, j'aime les choux de Bruxelles, and Francis is saying, moi, je n'aime pas les choux de Bruxelles. That is not a disagreement, of course, because it can be true that I like something and he doesn't like something. That's just descriptively true. So when they're taking the subjective reports of what I like, what you don't like, there's no real disagreement and no issue is joined. But suppose you took it, for whatever reason, that it is important to construe these judgments as though they do represent a real disagreement about whether these things do or do not have a certain property, Brussels sprouts. Well, once you get that far, you then might start feeling nervous about thinking, yes, but one of us has got to be right. At most, one of us is right, okay? And the other person has got to be mistaken, because you might think, well, where would this fact about whether Brussels sprouts really are or are not delicious come from? Where would it reside? Where is it in the world, this fact about the deliciousness of Brussels sprouts? Now, typically, of course, when you have disagreements in general, you do think that at most one person can be correct. Okay, so for instance, if it's about propositions like 5 and 6 on the handout, la terre est plate, la terre n'est pas plate, right? You think, well, both people can't be right. Either the world has a certain property or it does not have a certain property, the earth, that is, of being flat or not flat. But it does seem strange to take such a hard line in the case of the sprouts, and partly why that is that people have real difficulty imagining where this fact about the deliciousness of Brussels sprouts would come from, so that one person could be getting it right and the other person could be getting it wrong. Now, let me just emphasize, comme il dit sur le handout, attention, il ne s'agit pas seulement d'une affirmation épistémique. That is to say, this is not just an epistemic claim about two people being equally justified in holding their views. Because in the case of the flatness of the Earth, for instance, we believe that the Earth is spherical, and we have good reason to do so. But pre-Aristotelian Greeks did not believe that the Earth was spherical, and they had good reason to do so. So it's very easy in the case of factual descriptive statements where there is disagreement for two people to be equally justified, warranted, rational in holding their views. What we don't think is that they can both be ultimately correct in some ultimate sense. For instance, they can't both be true. They can be both justified, but they can't both be true. So when I say there can be faultless disagreements, I mean that there's something quite demanding. You get a faultless disagreement between a thinker A and a thinker B when A believes P and B genuinely disagrees with A. And going by the ultimate kind of correctness of which these judgments are capable, both A and B can be correct, not just justified. So now, let's turn to moral judgments. You might think, well, maybe you have good reason to take a view like faultless disagreement in the case of judgments of personal taste, as we call them, these judgments about whether a certain food tastes good, but how could it ever be a plausible view to have about moral judgments? Let's take 7 and 8, for example. Let's say, I say, educating women and girls is morally required and certainly morally permissible, and you imagine that Francis is a member of the Taliban?
I swear.
You draw the line there. Okay. Somebody else says it is morally impermissible to educate women and girls. Some people do believe that. Now, here, in this case, there is absolutely no difficulty with the first stage of that argument that I was giving in the case of the sprouts, of imagining that this is a real disagreement. There is no temptation to think these are just subjective reports, right? People really mean these moral claims, and they mean for them to clash. And but why would anybody think that such a disagreement, if it arises as it has arisen, is faultless? Why would anybody be tempted to think these things are such that both people could be right? Well, it's quite easy, surprisingly, to motivate. I'm ultimately going to say that we cannot make sense of it, but to motivate taking it seriously is not very hard. And the reason is, once again, that when you think about where these moral facts might come from, the ones that decide a dispute, a fundamental dispute about a topic of morality, we find it hard to explain where these facts could come from. They're not out there like the flatness of the earth or the protons and the electrons. And a lot of people these days are very uncomfortable thinking that they are made true by the dictates of an almighty being. So if they're not sitting out there in some normal sense, and they are not the dictates of an almighty being, then you might think, well, there really isn't anywhere for them to be. And secondly, even if you could somehow wrap your mind around the idea that there are such things, clearly coming to know which ones of them obtain is quite difficult, because you get all of these disputes and they don't seem to be resolvable in the same way as you would resolve an issue about the shape of the earth. It would be quite easy to resolve an issue about the shape of the earth, even to somebody who starts out denying it. You could show them all the evidence. But when it comes to morality, it seems much harder to see how to settle an issue like that. So, as I say, if you have that kind of worry about the existence of these objective moral facts, and yet you want to retain moral discourse, not throw it out, as you do with a discredited scientific theory, then faultless disagreement looks like a beckoning model for what's going on. Yes, there are statements. Yes, they disagree. But the disagreement has to be taken to be sans faute. Now, the question is, how can we make any sense at all of the idea of faultless disagreement? And here I want to look at two big ideas that people have looked at. One of them is to say, look, we're familiar with a very famous example of a relativistic thesis, and that is for Einstein's theory of relativity, right? Which showed us, I'm not going to go into the details, so you don't have to worry about that, that, for instance, certain properties that we thought were absolute, for instance, simultaneity, are really relative. That is to say, there is no such thing as the absolute simultaneity of two events. You have to specify a so-called spatio-temporal frame of reference in order to say whether two events are or are not simultaneous. And the two very same events can be simultaneous relative to one frame of reference, but one later than the other relative to another frame of reference. And so, and on, if you buy Einstein's view, which of course you should, it looks as though the moral is that we should no longer ever say something like 9 events 1 and 2 are simultaneous, but only say such things as 10 events E1 and E2 are simultaneous relative to variable frame of reference F. You have to relativize the claim in that way. So the idea is, well, look, we have a model for what it is to have a relativized view of a certain property that we get from this very famous important theory. Let's just apply it to the moral case and see, understand it like that. And of course, this is what Gilbert Harman did, who's a very prominent philosopher and one of the most prominent advocates of moral relativism in analytic philosophy. But when you apply this model to the moral case, it looks as though the idea is you should no longer say things like educating women and girls is morally permissible, that's number 7, but rather only 14, by the way, there are some numbers that are skipped, not to worry about that. 14, educating women and girls is morally permissible by a particular moral code, M, namely the moral code of 21st century Westerners or whatever. Okay? And the corresponding claim on the part of your Taliban opponent, if I may pick on the Taliban for a minute, educating women and girls is morally impermissible by the code of the Taliban. So these would be the replacement things that you would say if you took this model and applied it to the moral case. But the trouble is that if we are restricted to judgments like 14 and 14 star, then it's quite clear that we lose the disagreement completely, because it is obviously true that 14 and 14 star can be true at the same time. It is true that according to our code, this is permissible, and it's true that according to their code, it's impermissible. If you like, a related way of putting this point, it's as though it has been transformed, you see, into the kind of subjective report I like and I don't like. Actually, it's a little worse than that, because 14 and 14 star are really logical remarks about what does and does not follow from particular moral codes. And everybody can agree with that kind of logical remark. In fact, it's precisely because the Taliban agree that it follows from the moral code of the Westerners that women and girls should be educated, that they dislike the moral code of the Westerners. They agree with Proposition 14. And we agree with Proposition 14 star. That's why we think their code is bad. So if we are restricted simply to 14 and 14 star, a way to put the point is to say, you lose the subject matter of morality, because you take a moral judgment, like this is permissible, and you turn it into a logical remark, this is permissible according to such and so. And that completely loses the normative character of the moral judgments from which you began. Now, this is an interesting point about relativism more generally. That is, when you are a relativist about a given domain, when you give your relativistic view, you should not lose the subject matter of the domain. So if I'm a relativist about simultaneity, it should be the case that when I say what my view is, it's clearly a relativism about simultaneity. But here what's happened is that when we've applied it to the moral case, it's suddenly become a different subject matter, a logical and descriptive matter instead of a normative matter. So similarly, by the way, I think it would be hard to be a relativist about God, you see, because when you say God, okay, suppose you think God does not exist, okay, then you have two choices. You can either think, right, we should stop talking about God, or we can become relativists about God. Well, what does a relativist about God mean? It means that you think, well, according to the Judaic religion, there's a God and such and such, and according to the Christian religion, there's a God that's such and so. But these are just logical remarks, or if you like, anthropological remarks, about what different religions believe. They're not relativisms about God, they're just what anybody would say if they were describing what is the content of a given religion. So similarly, you lose the subject matter there. So one moral of this is, when you are a relativist, you should retain the subject matter that you're relativizing, and secondly, it's not always easy to see how to do that. The special theory cannot help us make sense of faultless disagreement because on the model it provides, it loses the disagreement and it loses the subject matter. In fact, those are related points. So the question then is, well, is there a better way of formulating faultless disagreement than through the so-called special theory? And now I have a long passage that is reproduced in French. You see, the problem traces to the fact that when we try to explain what the relativism about morality consists in, we try to pack that into the content of the statements that are being made. Okay? So then it takes these statements that are supposedly about moral permission and prohibition and turns them into these relational statements about what does and does not follow from a particular moral code. So the first thing we learn is if we want to be a relativist, you can't have the relativism be part of what is being said. It's somehow got to be there, but it's got to be hidden. Now you might think, well, how could you profit? Well, of course you can profit from hiding things, right? So the first thing seems to be that we have to find a way of formulating the relativism, but in a way that hides it and doesn't talk about it explicitly. And here is why people are very excited about what we now call truth relativism or aleithic relativism. The idea is we take statements like 7, we keep them as they are, okay? But we maintain a relativistic view of them by saying that they only have relative truth values, they don't have absolute truth values. That is, they only get... See, in the case of most things, judgments, take the case of the Earth is flat, once you specify what the world is like, that settles the question whether or not the judgment is true or false. That is, if you describe the world, you describe this big thing as having a certain shape, and then you look at the judgment, you think the Earth is flat. No, that's false, because the Earth is like this. And the idea is, in the case where you are treating certain judgments as having relativistic truth, once you've specified how the world is, that doesn't settle the question of the truth value. You also have to look at some further parameter, in this case, the moral code of who? Well, here we get an option, and we'll come back to that one. But roughly, of the person assessing the judgment or of the person making the judgment. So we will have those two things to play with. But the general idea is you fix the world, you haven't yet fixed the truth value, you have to specify a further thing. You see, you could think that in the case of the Brussels sprouts, because you could think, right, Brussels sprouts judgments are also like that. You can fix the world. That doesn't settle whether Brussels sprouts are delicious. You also have to specify the standard of taste with which the judgment is either being made or assessed. So now that looks like it might be very promising as a model for moral relativism, because if we look, we can say, keep judgment like 7. Somebody just says, look, it's permissible or it's not permissible. We don't mess with that judgment. But we maintain a relativistic outlook by saying, this only has truth values relative to arbitrary variable moral codes, and we have to tell you how that works in a second. So the normative character of the statement seems to be preserved because you haven't messed with it. And secondly, because 7 looks like, or 8 looks like it is the negation of 7, and we're allowed to say those kinds of things, it looks like we have preserved disagreement as well. So suddenly we might have a model for faultless disagreement through the use of relativism about truth itself. Now, by the way, how long do I speak?
Tu parles depuis 22 minutes.
Alors, ouais,
il y a tu as encore une demi-heure.
Okay. I want to talk about two big problems for this view. There are actually others, but I will only talk about two. The main one will be one I'll come to second, which is that we don't really get faultless disagreement being preserved after all, even though it looks like we're in a good neighborhood for that. But I want to talk about another problem first, which is something that really is underestimated, I think, by people who work on this. We have to look hard at the following three questions, which are also on the handout. We're now under the section
Relativism
à l'éthique et code moraux.
Wow.
There's a slight omission. Let me read that first sentence as it should be, because that was my fault, not yours. L'affirmation que les jugements moraux n'ont de valeur de vérité que relative à un code moral est très problématique. Je ne ferai que souligner que quelques problèmes, deux problèmes. So the first one is, what is a moral code? Second, what is it for someone to accept a particular moral code? And then, what is it for a judgment to be true relative to a moral code? Remember, these are all things that are very important parts of the theory, because the idea is different people accept different moral codes, and we can only talk about truth relative to them. Now, when you think about what we mean by a moral code, it's very natural to say just what Gilbert Harman does when he tries to describe them. He says, and I quote from him, Members of different cultures often have very different beliefs about right and wrong and often act quite differently on their beliefs. Some societies allow slavery. Some have caste systems which they take to be morally satisfactory. Others reject both slavery and caste systems as grossly unjust. So, you see, when Carmen is describing it, he's describing the moral code as consisting of a bunch of very general moral propositions. What else would they be? They specify your sense of, you know, what you take to be morally correct and incorrect. And so, if you go with this, and I don't know of a better way of doing it, accepting a moral code is accepting a certain bunch of these propositions as opposed to another. You accept the ones that have a caste system as opposed to ones that don't, and so forth. Now, the question is, look, how should you think about the truth value of these propositions that make up the moral code? If they are general moral propositions, they can be assessed for truth value. But, of course, you can't say that they have absolute truth values, because that would destroy the position. If you say they have only relative truth values, you have to answer the question, relative to what? Now, you could say, you can't really say relative to further moral codes, because now you've launched a kind of infinite regress. So you can only say, ultimately, they're true relative to themselves. Now, truth relative to itself presumably means that, I mean, you can make sense of it by saying that every proposition entails itself, right? Snow is white entails that snow is white, and grass is green entails that grass is green. Actually, grass is purple entails that grass is purple. So every proposition is true relative to itself. And so if what you're trying to do is explain what it is for me to accept one of these propositions as opposed to any other, and the rough idea would be to accept a proposition is roughly to accept it as true in some sense, then I have to accept all propositions in this sense, because I accept that each one of these propositions is true relative to itself, which is the only notion that I have been given to work with. So one big problem here is that we need to explain what, according to the relativist, it is to accept a particular moral code, and we don't have such an account. But as I say, the second problem is that we don't actually get a solution to the problem of faultless disagreement. And the reason for that is partly given by the following passage from a book by Mark Richard called When Truth Gives Out. I will start with that passage and then explain how the dialectic goes further. So maybe I'll read it in French just to make it easier for people. Quand on veut attribuer vérité ou fausseté à telle affirmation paix, on traite paix et l'affirmation que paix est vraie comme équivalente. Supposez que je pense que le Beaufort est un meilleur fromage que la Tomme et que vous pensiez le contraire. Supposez, pour simplifier, que chacune de ces pensées soit valide. La mienne est vraie de mon point de vue, la vôtre de votre. Alors, non seulement je peux dire valablement que le Beaufort est meilleur que la Tomme, mais je peux aussi dire valablement qu'il est vrai que le Beaufort est meilleur que la Tomme. Bien sûr, si vous pensez que la Tomme est meilleure que le Beaufort, plutôt que le contraire, je peux aussi dire valablement que vous pensez que ce n'est pas le cas que le Beaufort est meilleur que la Tomme. Je peux donc valablement dire qu'il est vrai que le Beaufort est meilleur que la Tomme, bien que vous pensiez que le Beaufort n'est pas meilleur que la Tomme. De là, suit à coup sûr que vous vous trompez. De là, il suit à coup sûr que vous vous trompez. Après tout, si vous avez une croyance fausse, vous vous trompez à propos de quelque chose. Okay. So, and as Richard says, this line of thought is completely general. It doesn't matter what the subject matter is. So, this is what Richard is saying. And Richard, by the way, is a truth relativist about these judgments of taste. But even as a truth relativist, he's recognizing that just because you're a truth relativist doesn't mean that you can take a disagreement to be faultless. Why? Well, suppose I do take the judgment that Beaufort is a better cheese than Tom to only have relative truth values. Then I say Beaufort is better than Tom. It's not supposed to be inconsistent with making an assertion. And that I say because it's true relative to my taste that Beaufort is better than Tom. Well, if I say that, then I'm going to say it's true that Beaufort is better than Tom. If I notice that you are saying something that's the negation of that, I'm going to say that it's false that Tom is better than Beaufort. And if I think that you have a false belief, then I have to think that you have made a mistake. And so even though I said that it was all relative, still, I have to judge that somebody who disagrees with me, or anyway, who believes the negation of what I believe, is making a mistake. And that's just a perfectly general argument. I'll call it the argument from immersion, because what it depends on is the idea that we've got a thinker who has opted for one standard of taste or one moral code as opposed to another, and from within that he's making certain judgments, and inevitably he cannot help but regard that somebody who is making an opposed judgment is making a mistake, despite the fact that we're supposed to be relativists about the truth of these judgments. And that's all laid out under this l'argument de l'immersion perspectivale. I won't bother reading through it, because it just lays out cleanly what the argument is. Actually, unless somebody needs me to do that. So, now here's the dilemma that I'd like to pose for the truth relativist in connection with faultless disagreement. It's this thing called dilemma. If this argument from immersion is accepted, then truth relativism is not a recognizable form of anti-objectivism, okay, and is anyway unstable. On the other hand, the only plausible way to reject it leads back to the problems with disagreement and loss of normative content. So that's the dilemma. Now I'll argue for each horn separately. So to accept the argument from immersion is to think, right, even as you are a truth relativist, you cannot make sense of faultless disagreement. Okay? Because if you are a committed thinker, you will regard somebody who is disagreeing with you to be making a mistake. Now, first of all, that doesn't look like a form of anti-objectivism, because to hold that on the question whether Brussels sprouts are or are not delicious, there's only one correct answer, is precisely what the realist would say. So what was the point of being relativist about truth in the first place? That's point number one. Secondly, now remember also that this is not just a theorist's perspective, because it's supposed to be possible for somebody to adopt a relativist position even as they continue to make these judgments. Secondly, if I'm holding that anybody who disagrees with me about a certain issue is making a mistake, then am I really treating all of these relative truth values as on a par? Surely I am privileging some of them, namely the ones that are delivered by my code, over the others. So why think that there isn't some privileged truth value, or even if you like an absolute truth value, namely the truth value that it gets relative to the code that I privilege? So that's a pair of problems for simply accepting the argument from immersion in the context of a relativistic view of truth. Now, what option do we have if we want to reject the argument from immersion, which has led us to the view that even on a truth relativist view, there is no such thing as faultless disagreement? Well, if you go through these premises, 20 through 23, you will see that there's really only one option, and that is number 23, which says, if it's valid, by valid I mean true relative to the moral code being used, if it's valid for a person D to judge that it's false that not P, this is the interlocutor's view, then it's valid for D to judge that anyone who judges that not P, for instance N, is making a mistake. Remember, this is where the crucial move takes place. The idea is that if I believe that a view of yours is false, then I'm committed to holding that you are making a mistake. Now, what this premise is doing is connecting an attribution of a truth value with a normative assessment of the correctness of your judgment. And the question is, do we have any room for play there? Can we get rid of 23 and substitute something else in its place? Well, you see, if you just believed in absolute truth, you would have a norm like this, what I'm calling absolute belief. A thinker's belief that P will be correct if and only if P is absolutely true. And the question then is, since obviously the relativist about truth is not going to accept that, what should he put in its place? And as I say, here there are two options. There is assessor relative belief, which says a thinker's belief that P is correct if and only if P is true as judged from within the assessor's perspective, versus thinker relative belief, which says that a thinker's belief that P is correct if and only if P is true as judged from the thinker's perspective. And if you think about it, the argument from immersion is basically endorsing a kind of assessor relative norm, because what it's saying is, the minute you disagree with me, I'm going to consider you to have made a mistake. But suppose I use a thinker relative norm, in which a judgment is correct, not in case it agrees with me, but in case it agrees with your moral code. So I will judge my judgment that P to be correct just in case it's true relative to my code. But if I notice that your judgment that not P is true relative to your code, then even though it's not true relative to my code, I will judge your judgment to be correct. Right? And that's what it would be to call it to be thinker relative. And now I no longer have to say that just because you said not P when I said P, your judgment has to be a mistake to be correct. So suddenly, now we have P and not P being correct, which is what we wanted, faultless disagreement. The trouble is that the situation here is exactly analogous to the situation that two people would be in if one of them said it's morning in the morning and another person said it's afternoon in the afternoon. Okay. It's morning disagrees in some sense with it's afternoon, but clearly there is no disagreement between the person who says it's morning in the morning and it's therefore correct and the person who says it's afternoon in the afternoon and is therefore correct. There is no disagreement, even though if you just look at the sentences, and this is what the phenomenon we're familiar with in the case of indexicals, that it's morning is, it's afternoon is somehow the negation of it's morning, taken as sentences. But when you look at the token judgments that are made, which are the only things that are being assessed, then when you say these judgments have to be assessed relative to the context in which they were made, or by the people in which they were made and the times at which they were made, then it's quite clear that although you get equal correctness, there is also no real disagreement. So once again, we have failed to find a model for something that's a genuine disagreement, but in which both sides count as correct. Now, so this completes my discussion of what I call thoroughgoing relativisms and their ability to make sense of faultless disagreement. What I mean by thoroughgoing relativisms is views in which you cannot find any commitment to an absolute moral fact. Okay. There is no commitment there. But there is another family of views which have also been called relativistic, but which are not thoroughgoing in the same way. And I think of this as a model for the way we think about etiquette. Okay. If you ask yourself, well, you know, what, I mean, surely etiquette is a relativistic domain in some sense, right? Nobody thinks there's some absolute fact of the matter about whether you should or should not eat noisily. I mean, in Paris, maybe you should not eat noisily, but in Xi'an, it can sometimes be polite precisely to eat noisily and show a relish of the food and so forth. So how should we understand that? You might think, look, there's got to be something wrong with your argument because we know that there are domains like etiquette for which relativism is completely appropriate. And so you must be proving too much. How should we handle etiquette? Now, the point about etiquette, I think, is that, in fact, it's not a domain in which there is no commitment to any absolute normative principle. On the contrary, the way it works is there is a very overarching general principle that says, with respect to a very limited range of behaviors, table manners and so on, but not, of course, the treatment of children and the elderly and so forth and so on, you ought to do what local custom does, roughly. I mean, if you actually tried to formulate what the correct principle is for etiquette, you'd see it's extremely difficult. But roughly, it is fall in, you should do what local custom does, but for this very narrow range of behaviors. Now, that principle is a universal absolute principle. It's an absolute normative fact. But it has in it a place for roughly cultural location or geography or whatever, which can vary wildly and prescribes different things under different values of that parameter, namely your location and who else is around you. And views like that have often been described as relativistic, and I have no problem with that. All you have to do is understand that it's a different, very different kind of view from the view we've been discussing. And the big difference between them is that on this view, there is a commitment to there being some absolute normative fact. Now, the importance of this is that it takes away the two main motivations with which I introduced relativism. The two main motivations with which I introduced relativism were, one, it's very hard to see how there could be any absolute normative fact simply sitting out there. And B, it's very hard to see how we could know about them given that they are there. Okay? Now, once you have introduced at least one of these things, which you have done in the kind of model of etiquette I'm just now describing, those two cards are taken away from you. You can no longer say, oh, I've got these scruples about objective normative facts, or I've got scruples about how we can know, because you have committed yourself to one of them, namely this thing that says, you know, depending on your location, you ought to do different things. So that's one very, very important thing from a philosopher's point of view. It's a dialectical altering commitment. Now you might think, okay, look, suppose I take that on board. I understand that we can't make sense of faultless disagreement. I want to model my view of morality on etiquette, which would, after all, be a huge thing. So there is a thing called here, morality like etiquette. And it might say, on a wide range, I say a certain range, but on a wide range of morally sensitive questions, one ought to do that which the members of the community one finds oneself in find it most natural to do. See, now you have a different formulation of moral relativism, one that isn't about moral disagreement, but tries to model it on this kind of spare normative principle that I was saying lies at the back of etiquette. But if you had something like this, most people would regard that as highly relativistic. Right? Now, the problem with this is that it's simply normatively implausible. Once you are in the realm of saying there are some normative facts and we do know about some of them, then we start discussing, well, what kinds of facts are there? And that is now no longer a question that you can reject because you've committed yourself to there being some. When I look at a statement like this and I say, really, you mean if I go to a community in which they abuse their children, as it might happen, then the normatively correct thing for me to do, just like I'm not supposed to put my elbows on the table, I'm also supposed to abuse the children because that's what people are doing, you would think, obviously, that's incorrect. That's just normatively incorrect. It's within the game of giving and asking for moral reasons, which you are now playing, that is obviously a non-starter. And so this was the promise that I made, that I would argue that some formulations of relativism are incoherent and other ones, although can stand, are implausible. Now, this, of course, brings me to the question, well, okay, so we can't respond to any kind of suspicion that we might have about objective normative facts with a relativistic view of morality. I won't mention expressivism as an option, that's for the cognoscenti, but that might leave realism about such facts as an option, and we need to confront the question, well, how can we make sense of objective normative facts, and how can we make sense of our knowledge of them, but unfortunately time has run out.